It's 3 o'clock, and I'd like to get back to the council started promptly. So we're going to begin with Chancellor Thorpe, but given that he's got a few activities on his agenda for tomorrow and for Sunday in particular, we're going to let him limit his time with us and just respond to questions about topics that may be important to you. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. I guess I did want to make one statement to start off, and that's just that I know everybody's probably got in their mind the financial situation in the world. It's certainly going to impact us, and we and all of us will be rewarded by doing the right things now. This is the time when we'll find out whether we can make the right decisions for the university and position ourselves for when there's recovery, whenever that comes. And I think everybody's, the provost and Dick Mann and I and folks at GA are looking at everything carefully and trying to figure out the best steps that we can take. In the meantime, we just got to support each other and try to figure out the right things to do for our university. Make sure everybody knows we're thinking about this stuff, trying to do the best we can. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody has.
Yeah. So one of the implications, of course, is that a lot of people are delaying decisions about retirement.
Right.
And I wonder how you, in the early stages, see that impacting your planning process.
Right, so James Meeser and I don't agree on how fast the retirements of all the faculty are coming. So I've been hearing about all these retirements since I went to graduate school. And a lot of those people who were supposed to retire when I went to graduate school in the 80s still haven't retired. And we have a great faculty, so I think that's been good for Carolina. And I think if people, if folks delay retirement, then that gives us that much more time and flexibility to do the important new hiring that we have to do. So, Bernadette may have some more concrete thoughts on that.
Well, I don't have any more concrete information, but you may know that each year we send out to faculty who are eligible to retire information about their specific plans, and we have just sent that out. And so in a couple of weeks, we might be able to tell whether the retirement plan is dramatically down from what we would have expected, but we don't know yet. But I've heard those comments all the time.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Lazzia from the Department of Valley Health Sciences and School of Medicine. And given the state of the university, everybody's financial status, right now, is the university still committed to building a new airport and relocating it to Orange County?
Yes. As you may know, there's legislation that authorizes the Board of Governors to create an airport authority. At present, we are supporting the formation of the authority, but the authority, once it's formed, will have numerous uncertainties on its hands. Not only the financial situation, but also the fact that it will start over from the beginning with a study of where and whether to locate an airport. So, as many people here would agree, the General Aviation Airport has been good for Carolina, and we hope the authority will do a thorough job of determining whether and where an airport can be sited in Orange County. But I would say that certainly the current financial picture is one of many factors influencing exactly how that would unfold. Yeah.
Okay. I will just take this minute to encourage faculty council members in particular to join the celebration Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock for the installation of Chancellor Thorpe on Pope Place. So I hope a lot of you will be able to join us there. And with that, I'd like to turn out our provost, Bernadette Gray Little, for remarks and question and answer period.
I'll follow up on some of the content we just talked about. One of the areas that we have concern about once we have a financial situation like this is how solid the state budget is and what it means, what these changes mean for us. We have already been notified that we will have a 2% non-recurring cut in state appropriations this year. And the chances are that there will be an additional notification, formal notification, of an additional 3% within the next few days. And at present, what that means is that up to a total of 4% of the money that the state would have given us for a variety of things this year, we will not receive. Your deans and heads of the larger units know about this and have gotten information regarding that first 2% reduction, and again, we're likely to get an additional 2% within the next couple of weeks. So, there is that. And I have learned today that this is a scene that's being repeated around the country. Someone sent me information this morning from Virginia that they got a 6% cut. And from Georgia, 6 and 7% cuts and so on. So this is happening at universities around the country. I also wanted to mention that you know there's been a good deal of discussion over the last couple of years about enrollment growth, and in particular about the fact that the state of North Carolina has expects a large enrollment growth because of in-migration. And the university system projects that in 10 years we will have perhaps an additional 80,000 students who are completing high school and planning to go to colleges and universities throughout the country, but especially in North Carolina. Because of this, there have been plans and discussions about how campuses throughout the system can grow, and the extent to which they can grow. In an effort to be clear about the effects of enrollment growth here on campus, especially enrollment of undergraduates, we commissioned a study by an organization called Art and Science, which examined how enrollment growth affects students' perceptions, the likelihood that they will apply, and the likelihood that if they apply, they will, if they are accepted, they will come to the university. And one of the things that is very clear from that study is that students' perceptions of the desirability of the university are very much influenced by their perceptions that there are other students of high quality here. And to the extent that we are seen as attracting very talented students want to come here. So we want to keep that positive process going. And in order to ensure that as we have been growing, we'll continue to grow somewhat, to ensure that we continue to attract outstanding students, we have asked a group that will be co-chaired by Steve Farmer, who is Director of Undergraduate Admission, and Steve Resnick, Associate Dean for First Year Seminars and Undergraduate Academic Experiences, to have a group this year looking at ways in which we can ensure that the programs we offer to our incoming students are attractive to them and provide a high quality experience. We are also having discussions about the ways in which we can improve our success in attracting our first choice of graduate students as well, and so you'll hear more about that during the year. I also want to mention that we have two dean searches going on, Dean of Arts and Sciences and Dean of the School of Nursing. Bob Lewin is, Dean of Pharmacy is heading the nursing search, and they are at the point now that they have applicants that have not gotten to the point of settling on those who will come to interview, but that is well along. And the Arts and Sciences search, which is headed by Dean Boger of the law school, is a little bit behind that point. That is, they have begun to get applications in but are not at the review process yet, but they are both in progress. And I mentioned last time that we were going to have a review of our tenure practice and policy, and Jane Brown is going to chair that committee, and I expect that they'll have their first meeting within the next 2 to 3 weeks. And Ron Strauss will work closely with that committee. Those are my comments. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Bernadette. I think we've got a busy schedule, but I think we'll move through it okay. And I want to be sure and encourage questions, since we talked about last time how it's important to have some discussion. So I don't want frivolous questions, but that's usually not a problem with this group. And don't hesitate to stand up, mention your name and your affiliation, and we look forward to sharing information completely here at the Faculty Council. So with that, I'd like to turn to Steve Resnick, who will report from the Faculty Athletics Committee.
Thanks, Chair. Assume that you have all read and memorized the 8-page report that we submitted, and I want to leave time for questions about that, but I did want to start with a general remark, which is just what this Faculty Athletics Committee does. You could probably abstract this looking across the report, but we do four things mainly. One thing is we receive reports from various aspects of what goes on in the athletics department, from financing to various activities. And we listen to those reports and we ask lots of questions and make suggestions, give feedback, and that's something that we consider one of our jobs. Another thing is that if Mr. Bedour has a policy issue that he is debating, discussing, and wants additional input into it, he will bring it to us and we will interact with him and give feedback and suggestions and ask questions. Third thing is I'll get email from faculty members who have some question about something that's going on in the world of athletics, and we'll put that on the agenda and get a full discussion of that. And the final thing is we have an ongoing practice, which is that we do exit interviews with seniors who are athletes who are in their last year. We do interviews, group interviews, focus group sort of thing, and also we have a questionnaire that they complete. We use that to kind of gather data that we are proactive in saying to Mr. Dewar and the staff, this is something we need to be thinking about, that sort of thing. So those are the main things that we do. Reading our charge, it's interesting that the first thing it says there is concerned with informing the faculty. And as I thought about what we want to try to accomplish this year, I want to kind of maybe put a little more emphasis on that. And looking for opportunities to inform the faculty more about what goes on in UNC Carolina's world of athletics. One thing that one way that we're doing that is, you may have a couple of weeks ago got an email, there was a great email about an invitation from Coach Butch Davis to attend something called Faculty Football Lunch. Well, I would like to repeat that invitation, and actually Ann said that I could send a reminder to people on Faculty Council. The last one for the year will be Friday, November 7th, and at these lunches, on noon on that day, it is an opportunity to meet Coach Davis and ask questions about the football program, but also we have representatives there from the Academic Support Program, Leadership Academy, Student-Athlete Development, and it's a chance to learn more about other things that go on. And the football center right across the street, how many of you have been in the football center? Okay. How many of you have been in Greenlaw? A lot more. All right. Well, so to inform you as to what goes on there, the other thing that we're going to do is give a little tour of what goes on in that building, and I think you'll be surprised and interested to see some of what goes on in there. So in the spirit of informing the faculty, I hope that some of you will come join us on that Friday. And then the last thing is, this is something that I'm thinking about serving as chair of the Faculty Athletic Committee this year, goals. What I also want to try to do is do more to inform faculty and students about the other 25 sports. You know, we have 28 varsity sports here, three of which you are probably very familiar with, maybe one of you know one other, but those other sports are student athletes working very hard, competing in our name, and to try to get more interest and support in those other sports is something I'm going to try to do. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. I am now leaving time and encouraging questions about the report that we submitted for last year, which I should note, Lisa Broom was chair last year, but I will try to answer questions because I was there. Yes.
You can't let someone present such a long report without a question. On page 7, in the second paragraph from the bottom, begins, at the end of spring 2007, the average team GPA was 2.95. UNC was 5-3rd in the ACC honor roll. So I guess there's a glass half full or a glass half empty view of that. Does 2.95 mean that our students are taking rigorous courses and that GPA represents a fair estimate of how they're doing, as opposed to other schools that might have their athletes take easier majors? Well, what exactly does 2.95 mean, and what does tied for third in honor roll mean? What does that reflect in terms of our athletes here?
Okay, that's a tough question. Well, tied for third in the ACC, I think what that would suggest is the academic performance of our athletes is in the top tier of our conference. And I think comparisons of ACC with other conferences, ACC tends to rank above other conferences on most metrics of student athlete performance. So I would like to think that that reflects a variety of things. I think it reflects the commitment that our athletics department has to success, academic success on athletes. I think it reflects in some ways the academic support program that we have here, the tutors and that sort of stuff is very effective. And I would like to say that it also reflects an ambition among our student athletes to do more than just their sport. And one of the things that the Faculty Athletics Committee looks at each year is the distribution of majors, and making sure that it's not any particular clusters and that it is reasonable. And over the last year, it is very reasonable. The students are, some of them are majoring in business and some of them are majoring in sciences, and they're not all taking easy majors. So if this was much higher, I would be kind of worried. But I think that it does reflect a various array of undertakings.
So just as a follow-up, so when you have access then to the kinds of majors that student athletes have in other ACC schools, you see trends, positive or negative, in terms of our students or ACC students relative to students in other conferences?
That is a good question. As far as I know, we have not looked at that. I think that that is a good question, and I can make a note that this year when we look at distribution of majors to see if there's additional data that we can compare that with other schools. If we focus on Mr. Bedour says that information is not available. But I think that the information that we do look at is important, and we do it in a you know, this year, but we also do it as cumulative over time, looking for any trends that would be worrisome. Mark.
Since this isn't a question, I guess I don't fear the chair's wrath about it being privileged.
You smile.
Yeah, in response to Professor Bachmann's question, I think our sensitive. We're concerned about making sure that our athletes are performing as students and that they're not categorically different taking courses than the student body. I don't think we're particularly concerned that our students are taking more or less difficult courses than folks at Clemson or Duke. And I think the committee is very pleasantly pleased to see the array of majors that our student athletes are currently involved in.
Right. Interesting. Garland Hershey is a member of the faculty. He's authority. Yes.
Richard Weinberg, cell biology. Asking sort of an extension of this line of question. You point out that there are maybe three areas of the athletic program that everybody in the state not only has heard of, but religiously listens to and watches, and then there are perhaps 23 others that nobody's ever heard of. Is there any marked difference in the academic performance between the big time sports and the more collegial style sports, if that's the right word to use, the more obscure one?
Jack, is that a better question for you?
I'll try to respond in part. First of all, generally at Carolina, as well as in intercollegiate athletics across the country, men's student athletes perform academically at a somewhat lower level than women's student athletes. As to your question about sport differences, the data that I've looked at most recently suggests that you know, our football team is doing well, not quite so well right now as our basketball team. Our baseball team is doing very well. So in those three high-profile sports, and the other thing I would say is that relative to those three particularly high-profile sports, we have some men's sports who are doing even better, and some that are not doing quite so well. But I was going to include some brief remarks in my own comments about that general issue of academic performance. To me, the good news is our high-profile sports are doing, I think, quite well. And across the board, I think we do quite well on the measures we have.
One thing I would add, whenever we see the various lists, it's not like there's always the same sport at the top of it. It really is just the variety and depends on what. Any other questions?
Steve, I thought those were kind of softball questions myself, so I wonder if you'd be willing to clarify if Ken made this difficult or awkward. But I noticed a bit about arrests of students, and I think that's a really complicated issue, and I don't know how it's handled for student-athletes or even for students, but it strikes me, has there been a change in the policy recently? Is that what you're looking for? Do you know what I mean?
Yes. The policy was reviewed in light of some situations that have emerged in this part of the state that did not involve us, but it caused, I think, a lot of schools to look at their policies on those issues and make sure that they were up to date. Mr. Manure, would you like to?
Yes, sir. We have a policy for maybe 12 or 13 years that makes a presumption. Well, on the arrest of a felon, excludes the student-athlete just on the arrest. Doesn't exclude the student from practice, but excludes the student from representing the university. So in competition, if you're arrested for a felony, that policy required us to not allow the student to play. I asked the faculty committee on athletics and the university's legal staff to help us think through that, whether or not that was where we wanted to be. We discussed it over, I think, a couple of meetings, and we came out with that with a slight with the same policy, with a slight modification, which is we'll make that presumption that if you were arrested for a felony that you cannot represent at the university, but it allows for extenuating circumstances or review by the athletic director in consultation with the chancellor that would allow us to permit the students to represent the university. That was the chance.
Any other questions? And Jack Evans is our NCAA rep, and he'll report as well.
As Steve mentioned, with respect to the committee report, the brief report that I prepared, I think, has been available in advance, so I'm going to assume that those of you who are interested in that 2.5 pages have already looked at it. One link that exists between my report and the report of the Faculty Athletics Committee is simply in the fact that I am an ex officio member of that committee. So I've been a participant in all of the activities of that committee for the past year. And in my report, I tried to list in an appendix the dozen or so things that are recurring activities of the Faculty Athletics Representative. I included in the body of the report brief reference to three things that were sort of unique to the 2007-2008 year. I'll just mention those quickly. One of them was that I, along with several other people from the committee, were participants on the Task Force on Priority Registration. Many of you will recall that that led to a recommendation to you that you considered at the December meeting last year. I participated as a member of the search committee for a new men's lacrosse coach. If you're interested in men's lacrosse, I think you're going to find that we have attracted to Carolina someone who is going to be a very good representative of our coaching staff in that sport. And third, there was a personnel matter that emerged in the Department of Athletics on which the Director of Athletics invited me, along with three or four other members of the faculty, to confer with him as he thought through what his position on it was going to be. So that's a brief overview of what I would call the within the university activities. At the ACC level, as many of you I think already know, that on a number of operating matters in our conference, the faculty athletics representative does the voting. Now, on any matter of consequence, I would never cast that vote without concurring with the director of athletics and the chancellor if that were the issue. But if it's a legislative issue on as to whether or not we're going to add one more day to the recruiting schedule or subtract one day from the recruiting schedule, that usually doesn't require that we go confer with the chancellor about that. In this past year, I was a member of the ACC Executive Committee because the year prior to that, it had been my turn in the rotation to be president of the conference, so I was on the Executive Committee last year. At the NCAA level, for several years, I've been actively involved in NCAA academic reform. Specifically, I serve as a member of the Committee on Academic Performance, and I'm a member of two groups that are working on issues related to the sports of baseball and men's basketball. So I've been rather actively involved in that. I wanted to add some additional comments, and Professor Weinberg, I hope this will perhaps expand on the issue of academic performance, how we track it, and what results we're getting. We basically track academic performance of student athletes with two kinds of metrics. One is a graduation rate, which really measures what happens to a cohort of students, to a group of students that enter in 1 year, and we measure whether or not they graduate within a six-year pipeline. The other kind of metric is basically what happens with a squad in a given year. That metric is called an academic progress rate. Each year, the NCAA publishes national data on intercollegiate athletics. Now, let me think here. Data that they had published through April of last year had been summarized in the committee's report. So if you're interested in that status report, that is there. As it happens, this meeting is about 4 days ahead of the NCAA schedule of publishing the graduation success rates for their most recent update. So those data will be out, I guess that would be next Tuesday. When those data are available, I will prepare the usual sort of comparative data that I've put together in the past that give us an opportunity to see how we fare within the conference and how our conference compares with the other six major conferences. And I recall at the time when we reported on this information last year, Steve Bockenheimer asked a supplemental question as to how we compare to a group of peer schools. So we spent a little time thinking about what that group of peer schools should be, finally concluded that it should be the group of we started with a group of 14 schools that I think this institution typically uses as peer institutions. Two of those do not compete in Division I of intercollegiate athletics as we do. Those are Emory and Johns Hopkins. So the comparative data that I put together last year were how we compared within a set of 12 schools that include schools such as Michigan, Berkeley, Michigan, Texas, and so on. Those data show that we compared relatively well, particularly in the three high-profile sports. I don't track those data, frankly, in the other sports because those are not the sports that generate problems on a consistent basis. When the graduation data come out next week, we will be able to see how we compare to other schools. What I know at this point is I know what our data are, and our most recent graduation success rates are going to be quite respectable, and they're in the ranges where we would like them to be. Individual sports, particularly individual sports that have small numbers of student athletes on financial aid, because that's what the NCAA tracks, those data will show more variability from year to year simply because there are fewer of them in each of the groups. The other thing on which I will comment briefly is where our current academic progress rate data appear to be. We are now in the process of submitting our data through the 2007-08 year, that is through last year. Those data go through a process of corrections and adjustments just to make sure that we in the NCAA agree that we submitted them according to the right definitions. Then, if there are, that begins the NCAA's penalty process, which means there's a period of time that those schools that are subject to penalties have the opportunity to request waivers and appeals. The long story made short on that is those data won't be published until April of next year. However, I know what data we have submitted for this year. Our picture in this regard last year was a good one, and our picture this year looks every bit as good as it was last year. I prefer not to comment specifically about the data because the data aren't final yet. Looking ahead to next spring, you can anticipate that at least our data will be in the same good situation that they were a year ago. Finally, in conclusion, let me make just one other brief set of comments. Shortly after July 1, Chancellor Ford said to me that if I ever knew of an issue about athletics that I thought he should know about, that I should not hesitate to come inform him about that matter. Now, I consider that to be a very reassuring matter to indicate that I have the same access to Chancellor Ford that I have had to previous chancellors as I've been in this job. But I would hasten to add that I have every confidence that with the current administration of the Department of Athletics, if there's something going on in athletics that our chancellor needs to know about it, our director of athletics will in all likelihood have informed the chancellor about it before I need to. But that's a part of what I regard to be the culture of our Department of Athletics that I think is reassuring for all of us on the faculty, and I hope you feel the same way. I'd like to conclude there and see if anybody has questions about my portion of this reporting cycle. Softball questions or otherwise.
Any questions for Jack? I'm going to make a couple comments about the Backley Athletic Committee. My impression is it's the hardest working committee that we have, and I'm going to read the names of folks who were on the committee last year right in front of you. Lisa Broom, Glennis Cowell, Jack Evans, Noel Granger, Kathy Harris, Garland Hershey, George Lensing, Steve Resnick, Des Runyon, Helen Falchin, Barbara Wildemuth, and Rachel Willis. If you know one, two, three, or all of those people, you'll realize that committee would be a great committee for selecting distinguished chairs or running the Educational Policy Committee. And I'm really grateful that people with academic credentials that shine off the paper here are willing to put in such hard work on behalf of the university and the athletic arena. It's an important area, and I'm very grateful for their work. And I think the report that Steve put together shows how many topics they addressed directly and constructively. Thank you very much for that. Who's here from the committee? Just Garland? Lisa Broom was fantastic. Steve is pretty good, but she's going to be hard to replace.
So. I agree.
Good afternoon. I'm here representing the fixed term faculty committee of the Faculty Council, and Suzanne Gulledge from the Education School is our chair. I'm just going to read the announcement. The fixed term faculty committee of the Faculty Council invites the faculty to join us for a forum to discuss some questions that will help guide our work for the next year. These questions are two in number. What changes or new provisions should appear in policies that apply to fixed-term faculty? What would make being a full-time fixed-term faculty member at Carolina a more attractive career choice? The date of our forum will be Friday, November the 7th, and we will have two sessions. The first session will be from 10:30 until 12, when you can actually come by and talk to one of the committee members on a one-to-one basis. Then from 12:30 to 1:30, we will have a public forum where anybody can come, and we invite all faculty to come by to hear us in a panel discussion talk about these questions. This will take place in the Faculty Commons area of the campus Y. If there are any questions about any of this, I'll be more than happy to entertain them, and there are several of the other members of the committee here. So please come out and talk to us, because we're really trying to look at what fixed-term faculty actually do, how we can make it more attractive, and what we've discovered thus far is that every school across this campus has different policies that relate to fixed-term faculty. Different rules, different ways that you handle hiring, appointment, and that type of thing. So we're just trying to get some work done so that we can put forth something meaningful. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. Is Andy Perrin here? My eyes aren't working very well today. Andy would like to share a resolution coming out of the Educational Policy Committee.
Thanks, Joe, and I'm here as chair of the Educational Policy Committee for 2008-2009. I understand that Professor Kath Nelson was concerned that this resolution didn't seem quite as exciting or interesting as prior things that I've spoken to you about. And while I agree that it doesn't...
Your wife's ratting on me?
While I agree that it doesn't raise to the level of the Polk Foundation, the Achievement Index for Priority Registration, nevertheless, it is an important matter. So, the background here is that for a very long time, the university's bachelor degree has been an AB degree, which I will seek to pronounce, an Artium Bac Valoriatus, This has become a matter of some confusion, both because the standard has become a BA, the Bachelor of Arts, also because we no longer require classical languages in Greek as a piece of our bachelor's program, and finally because a number of the two most recently approved Bachelor of Arts degrees are actually approved as BAs. So we're now in a position of awarding both BAs and ABs. Subsequent to the request by the college and the registrar, the EBC agreed to endorse the prospect of making all future bachelor's degrees BAs, Bachelor of Arts degrees. And our understanding from the registrar is this can be done only going forward, so that all prior degrees will continue to be AB.
Are there any questions?
I just want to clarify that the previous degrees do not need to be changed to...
Our understanding after talking with Alice is that already assigned degrees will remain AB degrees in the system. The EPC gave approval for the registrar that would convert if necessary, but her sense at the time was that was not necessary.
If there are no questions, it's my understanding that because this comes out of committee, Joe, is that what we can vote on? I would be inclined to go ahead and vote on it, but if people would like to come back to it a month from now, that's okay. Joanne, what's your preference?
Vote now.
Okay, I thought. Is there any opposition to going ahead and voting on this change? Okay. All those in favor of making the change, as Amy described it, on the degrees to be granted, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. The next item is changes in post-tenure review policy, and those have been circulated both electronically and they're on the back. It seems to me that the changes are minimal and that the impact is positive where there is a change. And this is something that came in response to general administration looking over policies concerning post-tenure review as well as tenure. This is just the post-tenure review part. And I want to thank Bonnie Yankoskis, who led our faculty assembly delegation at GA last year, and Judith Wagner and Steve Bockenheimer and Pete Andrews, who paid a lot of attention and made a lot of suggestions, and GA was responsive to most of those concerns. So I think the document that you see here seems to be one that we can live with and in some ways even improves the process of post-tenure review slightly. But I'd be happy to answer questions or spend time on it if people would like. Right. And as Bernadette mentioned, we'll be looking at tenure issues during the upcoming year. There'll be a committee appointed to do that. So that's something that's coming. And that's also a response to initiatives from general administration. But this is just the post-tenure review part. All right. If that's all we need to say about that, I'm pleased that Brian Musician has come to join us today at Faculty Council. I'm going to let Brian share information about the 403B plan changes that some of you got an email about a couple of weeks ago. The floor will be open for additional questions, and I'm particularly pleased that Brenda Malone and Steve Bockenheimer are here to help answer questions. I know this is a fairly hot topic even before the financial changes of the last couple of weeks. So I look forward to finding out more, and I would just ask that when you have a question, please announce your name and affiliation, and remember that these people are helping us and trying to do the best they can, and they're responding to pressures from outside too. So we'll see if we can gain a little clarity here.
Thank you very much, Joe. I very much appreciate the invitation to be here this afternoon. I'm just going to do a brief opening, just basically
tell you who we have here this afternoon. The invitation, as Dr. Templeman just said, was as a result of recent IRS changes that change our responsibilities with respect to our core review program. We have a brief PowerPoint presentation for you, but in an effort to answer your questions as completely as possible, I'm pleased that we have with us today Ms. Penny McCollum, who is the Vice President of Human Resources at the General Administration, and then, of course, Brian Musician, who is the Senior Director of University Benefits. Hopefully, at the end of this, we'll be able to answer all of your questions, but primarily, the change results from changes to the IRS regs, and it does reflect what we think was an appropriate approach to dealing with and addressing the additional obligations that the university will have. So the approach we took was to do it as a system, and we think with that we have some greater economies of scale, and certainly some greater efficiency in terms of where we have it. So Brian's going to move us through if you want to answer questions. Thank you.
I will say that this has certainly been an emotional one, especially considering the last 2 weeks. I think the markets are down about 30%, not to make any more upset than you may already be about your accounts, but I think there's a state of worldwide that there's a concern about finances, and people are very concerned about that. I'm getting all kinds of questions from, can I get into the state retirement plan now? If you're in the optional retirement program, let me just remind folks that decision was irrevocable, unfortunately. I think there may be some delayed retirements as a result of the market as it exists right now. I'm just going to run through some slides, some metrics to kind of show you where we were at and where we're going. But just to kind of give you an overview, the IRS first issued 403B regulations back in 1964. I was a year old at that time. The IRS did not issue final regulations until 2007, 43 years later. The market, which primarily consists of nonprofit institutions, colleges, universities, K-12 institutions, are heavily involved in the 403B market. It was not very regulated by the IRS. Some markets were out of control more than others, particularly the government sector. A lot of the initial 403B regulations that were issued back in 1964, there were exemptions to government agencies. For example, one of the exemptions was that we didn't have to have a plan document that described what the plan did and how it operated. Essentially, we were just a payroll agency, collected premiums, sent them on to the vendors of your choices. In some colleges and universities and K-12 schools, there were institutions that had upwards of 70 to 100 different 403B vendors, with agents running all over campuses. That's not essentially why the IRS is coming in now to clamp down on it, because of the agents, but primarily because it really had gotten out of control and there was no compliance aspects to it. Beginning in January of 2009, there will be a lot more employer responsibility. There's a shift in responsibility in terms of where it used to lie. Employees used to be responsible for, when you signed that salary reduction agreement saying, I want $1,000 a month to go into my TI Prep or my Fidelity or my Valid account, you were essentially responsible for that. If you overcontributed at the end of the year, we'd work with the vendor to get your money back. You'd get sent a 1099 tax statement. You'd have to file that along with your income taxes. But essentially, you were responsible for that. If you took a loan from a program, essentially, you were responsible for making sure that you paid that loan back. But all of those responsibilities, as of 1109, shift now to the employer. So one of the things we decided to do was look at the program more broadly, look at it with our constituent universities within the UNC system, and I'll come to some additional information to give you some facts about that. But let's just take a look at some market share data in terms of where we are right now. We have 2,700 faculty and staff employees who are participating in our 403B program right now. You'll see that this breakdown, this is a percentage of the market share of employees participating. Primarily, the market share is split about 50% between TI, AA, CREF, and Fidelity, with all the other vendors filling in the parameters around that. Now let me show you another slide that kind of gives you a picture in terms of the 403B market, in terms of the annual contributions. We remit around $25 million a year to seven different vendors right now. When you look at the makeup now, TI, CREF, Fidelity, and AIG Valid make up 80% of the contributions. 80% of that $25 million is sent to three vendors, AIG Valley, PI and Prep, and Fidelity. Well, this wasn't one of the only premises that we were looking at with respect to what did we need to do in looking at the program. It wasn't just Shirley, let's look at market share and let's reduce the number of vendors and make life easier for everyone. That really wasn't it. What we did was we really looked a little bit deeper and said, let's look at the other constituent campuses. We started having dialogue with UNC General Administration, and we all started talking about this together. Throughout the UNC system, there are over 50 vendors right now. Those of you who have been around for a while know that there were probably 50 vendors, and there were, at one time here at UNC Chapel Hill. That has been reduced over the years to the current seven that we're working with right now. But on the campus level, when we look at this campus-wide for for 17 campuses, there are over 50 vendors right now. So we decided to take the approach to look at this more broadly. Rather than having 17 campuses put together a legal document, work with 17 different consultants, work with 17 different consultants at a legal counsel, and come out in different places, we felt that it was more efficient to bring ourselves together, look at this collectively, and see what kind of efficiencies we could get through the process. So we made the decision to implement a system-wide program. We announced to campus back in July that we were going to start this process. We sent out an all-employee communication in July, we've worked through the process now, and I guess the notice went out about the middle of last week announcing that we made the decision and have awarded the business to both PI, Prep, and Fidelity. Okay, so looking at the process in terms of vendor selection, we had 9 vendors who submitted proposals, one which was disqualified, and two that did not meet the minimum specifications outlined in the RFP. There was minimum criteria that was outlined. 5 of the 6 remaining vendors were brought in and interviewed as finalists for finalist presentations. As part of the competitive bid process, we reviewed each vendor on a variety of different components. We reviewed them for their investment offerings, their fee structures, their employee education tools, their service capabilities, their staffing, their administrative solutions, market share and technology, and we also considered, as one might imagine, a company's financial stability, especially considering the marketplace. So following the presentation and after careful deliberation, the committee made the decision to award the business to both TI and Prep and Fidelity. What does this mean in terms of where we're going? We've received some concerns from employees that we're going from 7 vendors down to 2, but there are going to be some features within this program that don't exist right now. For example, we're going to have a tiered investment structure. So tier 1 will consist of life cycle funds for people who want to make a quick and easy decision based on their age. They can enter into a life cycle fund. Tier 2 will provide a menu of core funds similar to what like we have in the optional retirement program. Tier 3 will provide an expanded class of mutual fund offerings, both through TI Prep and Fidelity. Fidelity has offered on their platform to include Vanguard funds, T. Rowe Price funds, and American funds. So we'll have a variety of those funds in addition to the Vanguard funds offered directly through Fidelity. And then the last tier is going to be a brokerage window. What does this give you access to? It gives you access to thousands of mutual funds that are available on the marketplace. There are more mutual funds available on the marketplace than there are actual stocks to invest in. So if you're looking for something and you're looking for a niche fund, you'll likely find it through the brokerage window. We're also going to be implementing 403b accounts, Roth 403b accounts. What is that? Many of you are aware of Roth IRA accounts, where you can put money in on an after-tax basis, take the money out tax-free after you have it in there for 5 years and you're 59 and a half. But right now there are income limits as to who can use Roth IRAs. There are no income limits subject to Roth 403Bs. If your plan offers the program, you can put the same $15,500 that you're putting in on a pre-tax basis in on an after-tax basis if you choose. You can't do both. It's either pre-tax, after-tax, or a combination of pre-tax and after-tax dollars. If you're over 50 and a half, you can do an additional $5,000. So you can do $20,500. We're also setting up the program to allow you to work with independent advisors. Many of you already do that, perhaps even through some of the programs or the providers we have right now, so that you can continue to work with your investment advisor, continue to have those fees deducted directly from your account. If your investment advisor does trades for you, they should be able to have access to your account. You give them power of attorney, sign an agreement with them. You should be able to continue to do that and have the fees deducted for those services directly withheld from your TI Crest and Fidelity account. An advantage in that you can do that and have it done on a pre-tax basis versus writing a check to an investment advisor directly. So where are we ending up? Employees who are already enrolled in Fidelity and TI Crest do not need to make any change. Perhaps they want to review if they're not already doing that right now, which I think many of you may be doing. Reviewing their asset allocation in light of new fund availability, because there will be a broader array of funds available. Employees enrolled in any of the five deselected vendors that will no longer be offered, if they want to continue participation in the 403B program after January 1, they do need to sign up with either TIAA CREF or Fidelity, but they can continue to retain their assets in their existing company. So if you're with one of the deselected vendors and you're concerned that you also have to move your funds as well, you don't have to do that at this time. We do caution individuals who do look to move to consolidate and perhaps simplify, because I've had that concern from folks. This is going to make it more complicated because I already use one vendor. Now I'm going to have to use two vendors. If you're going to consolidate, you're going to want to speak with your 403B provider that you're currently with. A lot of these older providers, again, there wasn't much employer oversight, so we were really a payroll agent. A lot of these older vendors, some of them may have surrender charges on the programs that you already have in place, meaning you may pay a big fee to move the money out and transfer to another vendor. So be very cautious about that and make sure you speak with the vendors who you have right now to discuss any fees that may be associated with your account. So that's pretty much the presentation that I was going to do this afternoon. I'll ask Kitty McCollum, and I'll ask Brenda Malone to join me up here if there are any questions. I have a feeling that maybe this was when you were waiting to ask your questions this afternoon. So we'd be happy to try and answer them now.
See if we can start with Greg here.
Greg Company of Biology. So currently, I'm with TIA Crest. Currently, there's a cap for what you can have taken out of your paycheck. Will that change with this, or is
it
still
going to
be a cap?
The caps are usually adjusted annually. There's an index that's looked at each year, and they adjust by $500. So, for example, 2 years ago, I imagine it might get adjusted this year. 2 years ago, it was $15,000. Now it's $15,500. So that cap does get adjusted from time to time.
Quick answer to your question is
no. Oh, right, yeah, it's not.
John
Sweeney, Journalism. I just want to make sure I understand. If you have one of the deselected vendors, you can retain assets, is that temporarily or forever?
You can retain assets forever with that.
Okay, but your new, anything new will go to one of those.
Right.
I'd also like to introduce Kitty McCollum. Kitty was for a few years here at UNC Chapel Hill, and now she's migrated down to General Administration.
Yes. David Gerber, Medicine. One question, so you had, if I understand correctly, you have three vendors that made up 50% of your participants, or a little more, and basically 80% of your assets. But we went down to two vendors. Can you elaborate a little bit more on, I can understand the more, we went from seven to two, but it seems like there was probably a cutoff somewhere between two and three.
Yeah, I mean, there really wasn't. When we went into this, we had looked at one point and said, you know, let's consider the maximum perhaps for each campus at six is what we were thinking at, which really would have only meant a reduction of one course. But we evaluated a number of different options, as I talked about. We looked at investment fees, we looked at market share, we looked at the ability of companies to grow the market, which of course we're concerned about, and across the 17 campus, not just here at Chapel Hill, but across the 17 campuses. So we looked at a number of individual criteria. Financial stability. I know there are a lot of folks who are very concerned, particularly about AIG. AIG had a big market share here, the second largest in our 403B program. I can say that, you know, we made that decision We're very comfortable with it. You know, we got to that point, and a lot of folks might not believe this, but before the AIG bailout came, we had already made our decisions and were close to awarding the business, and then AIG got its first bailout, and I think you all know they're in the process of getting another one. We've also recently been informed, if you're not an AIG participant, you should have received a letter if you are, that the AIG retirement component, which everybody knows is valid, AIG has put that out for sale and will likely be looking for a bidder to take that portion of their business over to repay some of this federal debt that they've taken on. So.
Yeah.
Deputy
Captain
Alford,
the other than the brief email that I got a couple weeks ago about this, how are you planning on disseminating this information more broadly across campus and making sure people have a forum to get their questions answered?
Yeah, we're going to be working on several aspects of communication plan. The initial announcement, we wanted to get out as soon as the award was made. Because once the award is made, vendors start talking in the vendor community, and we didn't want our folks to find out without hearing from us directly. But we are working on an enrollment packet for individuals that we hope to go out by the end of this month. We're going to work on information sessions on campus, throughout campus, for individuals to come, to meet with the vendors, as well as providing and supplementing that with individual counseling sessions, one-on-one sessions with the vendors that we'll offer as well. So. And if you're working with an investment advisor, you should be able to continue to work with that advisor in the scope of this program as well.
Right, but the current situation economically, I just find it discouraging that we're a U.S. system, state-based institution. We eliminated the North Carolina-based company that's extremely financially stable and is offering very good services. I just think we need to support the national guys.
But we also had to look at, and I'm not sure which company you were with, we had to look at the ability of companies to grow the market share throughout the state and to be able to service the state. So looking at a North Carolina-based company, we did get that just as much weight as all the other components we did in this process. We had to look at the aspects of whether or not an individual could service the state. And there are some particular providers that are linked right here to UNC Chapel Hill right now, and that's it, and not nowhere beyond that. So we were looking outside of the scope because we were looking at this as a system-wide plan, not just a chapter open. Katie, is there anything you wanted would like to add to that?
Did you look at how it fit before?
We looked at fees. We looked at fund lineup. Okay.
We looked at all of it and make proposals. And I first don't know who you're with. It's very likely that if you are with one of the companies that I've been hearing more about, where you like what they're doing as far as advising is concerned, that they will be able to continue to advise you to use a broad array of Fidelity funds, and you would be able to probably have the exact same access to funds that you have right now through them. Advising is not true at this time. And I will leave you,
there are some funds that will be eliminated. There are actually ones that are
Okay. And you put into that to know? Okay. Because with Fidelity, there are thousands of funds, as well as PI Credit has hundreds of funds available. So I'm really surprised to hear that.
I agree with the same thing, that Fidelity has a smaller platform than some of the other providers. And so some of the choices that we might currently enjoy under our existing de-selected provider may be available to us.
Well, now, Fidelity's making available all of its non-proprietary funds as well. I mean, Brian mentioned that Fidelity has probably quite 150 or so funds on their platform that are Fidelity funds, but they also will make available Vanguard funds, Stewart Price funds, American funds as part of their platform, and then you can go into their mutual fund window and find thousands of funds. So I'm not quite sure why there wouldn't be funds available. So maybe one
Joy and Pat for bringing up, I mean, your questions are more compatible with the emails I've been seeing, that's why we're discussing the faculty council, so I appreciate those questions. Do you want to say something?
I think so. But one part of that, it sounds like when you go through that brokerage window, you yourself would be responsible for making decisions. And I think several of us appreciate having advice and assistance in doing it because we lack the time to follow the market that closely. And so I'd like some assurance that we're going to be actually having that kind of good advice that we currently enjoy, even if those vendors weren't provided.
Yes, there would continue to be, here again, the registered investment advisors that Fidelity does contract with that would be available to you. I mean, I can't tell you exactly who all of those are, but there certainly is advice available through them that you can take advantage of.
I would also add to that, too, if you're working with a local advisor, I'd have to add two things. I'm not sure that even a local company right now could make the assessment based on how much information we shared about what won't be offered. We're talking about thousands of mutual funds through a brokerage window, so that just about covers an awful lot of bases, like bond funds and stock funds and niche markets. I mean, you're looking at an awful lot of funds that usually these other providers try to put on that platform anyway. And I'll also say, as I said earlier, you will be able to work with advisors in the scope of the program. So if you're working with an advisor right now, that's an independent advisor, not particularly just attached to one company. And I'll use an example. Verity, for example, is an independent advisory company. AIG Valic has advisors, but they're limited to working only with AIG Valic, the company itself. But Verity is not limited to working with just Verity accounts. They can work with you with your accounts. So if you have Verity right now as an example, you can continue to work with them, have them set up your portfolio. You would work through the logistics of getting your account set up. You would give them access to your account to do trades on your behalf, and they would continue to be able to deduct fees for the services that they are providing to you directly from either TIA Prep or Fidelity. So in the scope of it, it sounds to me like until there's a little bit more detail and we can point out specific funds, and we might have to take a look at that as we get closer to it. The other thing I didn't mention, I should mention to you here too, in the scope of this, one of the things the IRS is trying to accomplish in this process is to really get these programs down to looking like 401ks. You look at the state 401k and the state 457b plan, there's one provider in those programs with just an array of funds. You go out to corporate America and you get an account with a 401k, there's one provider. So the IRS is really trying to squeeze this down overall in higher education. And I should also mention, we're not the only state university system going through this right now. We've had conversations with Maryland and the Georgia state system, the California state system. The University of Kentucky just went through the same process a few years ago. They got it down to two vendors as well. So there's a process going on in the system itself right now in the 403B environment to reduce the number of vendors that are in place.
If I could, I'd like to ask Steve, would you be willing to come up if you don't want to? I mean, would you not? I mean, I really think the fact, one thing that I detect from the emails I'm getting is what happened? All of a sudden, we just get the news that we're down to two. So from the faculty perspective, it feels like we had a choice of seven where we're putting our own money and now we're down to two, and what's the reason? And I think, I mean, faculty were not informed ahead of time, but faculty were involved in the selection process, right, Steve?
Well, they were. I'm the chair of the University Insurance Committee, and I previously 403B plans were in our portfolio. There was a discussion hall last year about these plans, or at least the idea that there might be planning for reduction or consolidation of the 403B program. So certainly it hasn't been a secret. But of course, the University Insurance Committee doesn't have a high profile in faculty council or otherwise in the university. But it's certainly, there has been I think, fairly reasonable process put in place to discuss this issue. I think there's been representation of the entire university system in this proposal. I think in general, the committee felt certainly there ought to be a move to at least understand what the issues were and come up with a plan. The IRS has put the onus on the university to control this system. We can't simply defy the IRS and say, well, the status quo. I think this was a reasonable response to what the IRS has essentially demanded of all nonprofits.
Okay, no, I appreciate you sharing that. Other questions?
What? Most of the new funds that were developed, that's the current applicant fund, is that right? The expansion of the funds and things that they did not do that for this.
It's not on their platform right now.
Right. Correct. It's all new additions. Mm-hmm. So
correct.
Understand some
correct.
Of the thinking.
Right.
But that's the negotiation with Fidelity after they were selected, not before they were selected. Some of the funds and some of these bank expansions.
Well, in the proposal, we just asked them to give us their 20 funds, and then, of course, they were able to extend it after the award was made. And I think what will be helpful when we get the communication out to everyone and show you these tiers, you'll better understand that what really is available out there, and we're working very hard to make that information available to you.
Probably important to understand in other contexts here that, for example, in the case of the ORP, all these vendors have really changed their product lineup. Used to be proprietary funds exclusively. And that whole industry has changed, and many vendors have access to thousands of funds. So I don't think there's a lessening of choice here. I think it's just a process of making sure that people have a handle on mechanisms.
Question?
Yes. Yeah, David Stott, Computer Science Department. So there's uniformity here. All the tiers, the 403B, are going to be available for both vendors. If we choose one vendor, we're not limiting ourselves to something. Not talking individual funds, but the ability, for instance, to create a 403B. I can do that with either of these vendors.
I'll try to pose a question for email that I saw, but I may not be able to do it. Is it true that when if you go with one of the 403 vendors that we've selected, you have a complete array, or do these tiers cover everything? I've had faculty tell me that they can't even choose things within Fidelity, that there are certain investment vehicles that are off limits because they don't have somebody coming through the UNC system. Does that sound
not within the scope of the 403 program now? I mean, we have 150 Fidelity funds on the platform right now. We'll have 150 after it's done, and then an array of Vanguard and T. Rowe American funds, and then the brokerage window, which will give access to thousands of other mutual funds. I think that folks may be confusing that slightly with the optional retirement program, when there is a limitation of 20 funds per vendor.
Okay. Pardon my confusion. Any other questions? We've got the best group up here to answer questions that you're going to encounter.
So I think maybe one other, if one is in GIAA, CREP, it's their optional retirement fund, but it also investing in a 403B, those are two different things. And they
yes, that's
continue
correct.
To be two different things.
They
is that correct?
They actually come under different sections of the Internal Revenue Code, and there's a benefit for us doing that for you, because you can actually maximize the amount of contributions you can do. At one time, the ORP was a 403B program. That's probably telling you more than you need to know. But it's not anymore. It's under a different section of the IRS. But it gives you the maximization. I think the important component to that is it gives you the ability to maximize your contributions so that we don't have to subtract your 6% that you put into the ORP from your overall limit. Otherwise, if it was a 403B program, we would have to do that.
David?
I was going to say, I think that this lends some insight into the fact that while we've simplified some things, we've probably created more confusion in the process of people understanding what these different vehicles are. When you send out the information you're going to send out to clarify this, it may really help the faculty and staff to see what it's not impacting. So that they, you know, some of the faculty, as we've heard, have been here for a long time since our
right.
chancellor was a student. So it may give them an opportunity to kind of, you know, refresh exactly what this does impact, what it doesn't impact.
And we are working on a communication campaign once again. We will also have these reps out in the field talking to people about this. So we intend to fully get you all the information that you need.
Joe?
As somebody who's been deselected and knows absolutely not suppose my current financial advisor doesn't handle either one of these vendors. Are you going to give us a list of people who do? How do I know? How do I find somebody?
registered investment advisor.
And by calling after by that, or?
We're going to tell you. We will be communicating that. Yes, we'll make that information available.
A follow-up question. So I think I didn't make my previous question specific enough because I think I just heard a flipping answer. When I was talking about the cap, I meant the 6% cap. This falls outside that 6% cap.
That is correct.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yes.
Thank you.
Remember, we have a retirement plan. There are two types of state retirement, which is a guaranteed benefit. And then there's optional retirement, which is a guaranteed contribution. And then there's the supplemental retirement, where this all 403B falls under supplemental.
Which is voluntary, which is your money that you invest. Not any money the employer puts in on the
no money.
And I should add one other thing to that, just to make you, there's an interest there. Because an individual puts their 6% into either the state or the ORP, you can use $15,500 right now for 403B, and if you're interested in actually maximizing even more, you can do $15,000, another separate $15,000 to a 457 plan. So there's lots of opportunities to defer money.
Events of the last 2 weeks have caught my attention about things I never thought I'd think about in my life. And since there are people with such expertise here, I'd like to ask them, suppose the apocalypse happens, not the real apocalypse, but let's say, you know, major insurance companies start going bankrupt and God knows what happens. What kinds of plausible bad case scenarios might come up and what would be their consequence to us in these programs, 403B, 401K, through the university, et cetera?
Well, you know, most of the funds that you're that are offered through these programs provide no safety net. They don't provide any FDIC coverage. They don't provide any SBIC, I think, is another one for independent brokerage accounts, not for brokerage accounts through these programs. You do have one safety net, and that is, you know, some of these fixed accounts offered. TIA Prep Office is a fixed account. Its fixed account in the supplemental program right now is paying 4.5%.
Is it possible that TIA Prep could go bankrupt?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to ever say never say never. But looking at ratings, like for example, when we looked at ratings as one of the financial stabilities of a company, TIA Prep is only one of three insurance companies in the nation that receives the highest rating from all rating agencies, so Moody's and Fitch and all the companies that rate them. TIA Prep is the only one for its TIA fund that receives that three companies. Northwestern Mutual is another, and I quite honestly don't know who the third one is. AIG's rating was getting downgraded overall, and was getting downgraded again during this process. And so is there any guarantees? I can't say there's any guarantees.
Which one of them, yeah, right? If you're right. Burned, it's a 100-year-old company,
right.
You'd rather be great crashing it with it.
Right.
I mean, I guess the one thing to say is that there are always different risks. But I believe that the two managers that have been selected have a consistent record. And I think that's really, really important given where we are.
I'll add one other thing to that too, because I have participated in a couple of things. I heard from our TIA Prep representative today, who said that anybody who is a wealth management client of TIA Prep, and they kind of set a standard of if you have $250,000 or more, well, maybe that's changed in the last 2 days, I'm sure. But those who are and were part of that standard, they're reaching out to, if you haven't called them in the last couple of weeks, they're reaching out to all of their clients. They're keeping their phone center open this weekend, the entire weekend, to be able to talk with people about the concerns they have, about whether or not they need to make some market changes right now. So they're looking at that. Another interesting statistic I heard from sitting on a conference call with the CEO of TIA Prep recently that they sent out for benefit administrators, TIA Prep pays out $10 billion a year in pension benefits, second only to Social Security. So I thought that would be an interesting to throw out here just to kind of show you a little bit of their financial security in terms of their ability to make claims. So, yes.
I would just make a comment about TIAA from the only investment thinking that I had in my 26, 27 years of teaching. And I would just say that I talked to them last week with the first crash. Now, the wait time to get on the phone with them is about 25 minutes. So I just set my speakerphone on my cell phone so that I could continue my work. But they stayed on the phone with me for about 30 minutes and kept asking, is there more? What can we say? They were so very patient in working it out. And the office was the same when I went in to the office. So I would say TIA is really trying to inform people, especially people like me that are not very knowledgeable about the market, about what might be good advice, and they are just favorably been one of the women's writers.
Thanks for sharing that. And for those of you who aren't familiar, TI Prep does have a local office here, actually over by the quadrangle. And we do have information about our local representative and their contact information out on our 403B website. So if you need to call someone over there, you can sort of set up an appointment. Fidelity has an office out by South Point, by the streets of South Point Mall. They have an investment center there. Their representative primarily comes to campus, but if you need an appointment there, I'm sure they can arrange them forward as well.
If there are any other questions, I want to thank these four people for all being willing to come today and answer important questions about how we got to this point in the investment plan.
And Jill, just to say, if there are other questions that come to mind, after you leave here and you go, oops, please feel free to call or email, and we'll definitely get back to you to answer all those questions. And the questions that have been raised have been particularly helpful in making sure that we send out communication information that's complete and that really, really does kind of address all of your concerns. So thanks very, very much.
One thing I'll ask as they head back to their seats, I think this is a foolish question, but how many faculty council members would like to get warning a month or 2 months ahead? By the way, get ready, there's going to be a change in your 403B plan. You know what I mean? That didn't happen this time, if I understand correctly. Would that be something that's helpful, or would that be something that it just worried people?
No, we did send a notice out in July saying that we were in this process, but we did send an initial communication out. Now, granted, one of the things we've talked about since is that perhaps maybe even in advance of the notice we sent out, we should have sent that out as a second reminder, because it may have been folks away during the summer, but in retrospect, so yeah, perhaps that a refresher of that.
Somehow I think people were surprised when they got the email saying this is. Okay, Judith Palau is here, and she's going to introduce a resolution concerning scholars of rigor.
Thank you. I have two very quick points that I'll make, but first let me preface my remarks with the students, as usual, are ahead of us. Last Wednesday, there was a co-sponsored campus-wide Latin American Studies and SEJ discussion group, and the speaker was from Columbia, who was an activist, who led and scholars at risk, SAR, helped to find the Duke University department for her. So she was a student at Duke. And I've had contact with her. She's learning English, and the event was very successful. So our students are there. I urge you to support SAR. The timing of my proposal is not very good, because you've heard all the economic bad news, and you're watching and talking to folks of the department closely. But the bringing a SAR scholar to campus, for one semester to teach and research in the department would come out of department fund. We have proposed a small endowment by the university to help departments. And the two important points, I think, are so obvious. I mean, we are enriched when we bring scholars from different countries to our campus. Our undergraduates and graduate students learn so much from people who come from Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, who have bring, fresh experiences of war and struggle in their own countries. And second, we have more obligation, universities and faculty have always, not consistently, but we're proud of those periods of time, such as now in Germany, when we sponsored German and Austrian scholars, helped them to get out of their country and come and teach in American universities. So I hope that you support our resolution.
It's my understanding that, is there a discussion about this? Yes.
Actually, I have a brief question. What effort is being made to seek funding sources for this under the departmental funds? And I ask that only because, while philosophically I very much support this, I come from a department where, you know, we were told we can't even get cost of living raises, that we can't hire necessary new faculty, and to be told that this would have to come out of the department fund, it seems to me that it's going to limit opportunities to use this program as well as we could if funding came from other sources.
I and the other committee members received the names of scholars in particular fields, and these are all highly qualified publications. They read and write English, they published in English language journals. So we've done the initial screening and we contact the department and hope that departmental funds that might be used for a temporary adjunct for one semester might be rolled over to support a SAR scholar. And the expectation is the person is working for that money. It's not charity. And then the expectation is that after one semester, the person will have found a permanent position in this university somewhere else. New York office headquarters, the center of the network at New York University, is incredibly helpful at finding placements, not only in American universities, but also in European universities.
Yes.
Andrew Chin, Law School. I certainly plan to bring the network to the attention of our asylum and immigration committee at law school, but I was wondering if you happen to be in a position to speak to whether there were any formal connections between SAR and the immigration committees that around the country that can serve the asylum representation.
I don't know that for sure. I know that Amnesty and SAR were close together, and there's another organization that does essentially what SAR does, so they work hand in hand. And of course, they're European counterparts.
Any other questions or comments? We can sure go ahead and vote on the resolution now, which is perfectly okay, but we can delay it until the next meeting. What's your preference? Vote. Any objections to going ahead? Okay, all those in favor of the resolution presented by Judith concerning scholars at risk, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you. The resolution is passed, and the last item on the agenda is to go into closed session to consider honorary degrees. So I would ask the press and not members of faculty council, please excuse themselves. Members of faculty may remain. We'd love to have faculty members here in the room.
You don't have to leave the hall.